You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The open air advantage, rising above the saturation, and dreams of performing a lost Shakespeare play. What do all of these things have in common? They represent ideas of today's guest on this episode. I'm your host, Sean Chandler, and you're listening to Your Program Is Your Ticket, a discussion of smaller theater works and the people and organizations that make it happen. Today's guest is Dustin Welch, Artistic Director of the Cleveland Shakespeare Festival. Dustin is part of my new Theater is for Everyone series, where I'm interviewing theater artists outside of the major locales to give them a chance to be heard, to discuss their work selection and production processes, while touching on their triumphs, challenges, and misconceptions. The Cleveland Shakespeare Festival is dedicated to bringing plays of professional quality to audiences in the greater Cleveland area as a way of encouraging community through theater with an emphasis on local professional artists, making the words and poetry of each play accessible to family members of all ages and cultural backgrounds. Now, please keep in mind that our interviews are recorded at different times to optimize schedules, just in case the audio sounds different. I'm super excited, so let's bring them on. Hi, Dustin, and welcome to Your Program Is Your Ticket.
Hi, thanks for having me. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. How's Cleveland?
Cleveland's doing well. Relatively warm day out today. Surprising for a December day this late in the year, but it's not too bad. Thank you.
Good. It's kind of like that here too. We've had like 60 degree days, 2 weeks before Christmas, and I don't know. I can't explain it, but I'm not a weatherman, so I just really like saying, "How's Cleveland?" Do you know why?
Why?
Why? Okay, because it's from Tootsie, the movie.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Yeah,
very cool.
Yeah. When they say they're in the booth and Tootsie's acting, or Dorothy Michaels, if you will, with other people, and the camera gets, they have this joke. It's like, okay, close up. Not too close. Okay, now you need to pull back. How far? And one of the characters goes, "How's Cleveland?" Love that line.
Very nice. I'm glad you get to use it.
Thank you. Cleveland is, and Ohio overall has been a great friend to your program, Is Your Ticket. Mm. I've done a lot of interviews there, Broadway Princess Party, Broadway Comes to Chagrin. I interviewed people from the Gilmore Academy, staff and students. It's just a great place. And I think the Gilmore Academy has this big, beautiful, arts complex now.
Yes.
Have you seen it?
I have not actually seen it, but I know, it was a big to-do, right, during the process, and they did a lot of promoting, and it's wonderful. Yeah.
I got to tour it, and it's so big that the rehearsal room that they have, I could fit my entire New York apartment inside this rehearsal. It's huge. I'm like, wow, this is really great that they have that available for teaching. And so anyways.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love Ohio. I love Cleveland. My husband's people are from Ohio. So.
Oh, nice. Nice. Yeah. Cleveland is a wonderful place. Ohio is wonderful. I mean, there's a lot going on here. And I think that it's often overlooked, but there really is. There's so much activity and so much things that are happening, so many things that are happening. It's really wonderful, and it's great to be a part of that.
Well, we're going to talk about that. The reason why I started this series is because I wanted to give – this is pretty much the goal of my podcast anyways, but I wanted to really emphasize theater areas that sort of have to almost compete with New York or LA, but not really. Like, how does that make you feel about it? Are you on an island? So I really would love to get a good perspective on that. But
yeah,
Let's start by having you introduce yourself to our listeners and telling us about the Cleveland Shakespeare Festival, please.
Yeah. So Cleveland Shakespeare Festival, it's Cleveland's premier free theater. Our seasons consist of touring productions, that we perform primarily outside. We go to the parks and outdoor performance areas, all across Northeast Ohio. Every single one of our shows, every one of our performances are held in a different location. So we will travel to one of the neighboring communities for one show for Friday night. Saturday will be in a completely, the opposite side of town. And because of that, we have audiences from, all of the different communities. But what's important is that we bring our theater to them, opposed to, asking them to drive downtown or hop in a cab or whatever it may be. As I said at the start, all of our shows are absolutely free for all of our patrons to attend. And that is huge, a part of our, a part of our mission. This coming year, 2022 is going to mark our 25th season. So we've been around for a decent while, which is really nice. But this is only my second year as artistic director with the festival. Before that, I was the director of operations, for a couple of years. And then before that, I was an off again, on again director, choreographer, and actor with the company since about 2008. It's been a great process, and I'm very proud of the work that we've done through, the many years that I've been a part of the festival. And I couldn't be happier, with where we've come and where we are heading. I'm really excited about just the prospects that we have in the future.
Excellent. Love it. Free is cool and so helpful to people who don't have sometimes the money to spend on theater. It can be very, very expensive. Yeah. So providing that experience to everyone without a cost is huge. And it also means that it's up to the theater company to obtain the funds that they need to actually run the productions, which aren't cheap. So that's probably a lot of grant writing and donations and things like that, right?
That's exactly it. Grant writing, donations make up a majority of our income, of our funds. And we're looking at expanding our sponsorship program as well as partnership programs to help with that. So it is a cost to us, and it is, it's hard at times. Honestly, you get out there and you do this for free. You offer up this wonderful service and you find people who go, this is wonderful. This is great. We want this to continue. So we're going to give you money, even though you're not requiring it of your patrons, to allow it to exist and survive for, the many audiences who, as you said, may not be able to afford it, or, may not be able to afford at least, not what a typical theater ticket would entail. So,
yeah, and that's great, because this is from what I can see, and as you had said before, this is your company goes to they go to locations. They almost tour. I mean, I've got their your tour schedule here: Cleveland Heights, Berea, I think
Berea, but yes, yeah,
Berea. Okay. Bay Village, Cleveland, Lorraine, Mint. I mean, just that's wild. Now, are most of these venues that you go to, are they outdoor?
Yeah. So we didn't do this last year because of the pandemic, but do have rain spaces in case, the weather doesn't permit. So usually housed within somewhere near the performance venue that we would go to. But yeah, all of our shows are completely outdoors. They're intended to be so. We go in, sometimes there's a stage that's pronounced. Sometimes it's elevated above the ground. Sometimes it's kind of more flat. Sometimes we perform in, a grassy field, essentially. There's a backdrop of maybe trees or something along those lines, or we've got the lake in the background in a couple of our venues, which is wonderful. But the purpose of us is that we can set up anywhere, and we can do it in, you know, and because of it being in all of these different spaces, it can actually be a little bit of a challenge in a good way for the actors and the director, choreographer, because they don't know exactly what it's going to be. We perform on flat stages. Sometimes they're wooden. Sometimes they're concrete. Mm-hmm. We perform on, as I said, the grass. So sometimes there's little divots and unevenness. Sometimes, you know, our stage is, you know, maybe a 20 by 20 feet, area. Sometimes it's only 18 by 18 or 16 by 16 or 100 by 100, you know. So we have a lot of constrictions and constraints that come in that we have to adapt to on a daily basis, which, as I said, can be a challenge, but can also be really rewarding for the artists involved, because it just kind of requires them to think about things that they can take for granted, elsewhere, which is, you know, it's good.
Right. Yeah. It reminds me of my husband, David, and I wrote a play called At the Flash, and it's a one person, five character, five decade play that's intercut back and forth. He performs it. And we performed it in like six or seven locations, including in Dublin. And each and every time, it's been a different type of stage. And it's almost like you have to redirect it a little bit in a way. And for him, he's the only person up there, so he has free reign. But I can imagine that might be a little difficult and maybe need a little extra rehearsal time at the location to have you redirect and have the actors and technicians like accommodate that.
It does. During the rehearsal process, that's one thing that we absolutely drill in. Inevitably we don't have a full committed company of actors, but we do have some members that have been, we actually have one member who has been a part of the, been a part of the festival for, I think, 23 out of the 25 seasons now. Wow. He's fantastic. A shout out to Alan. He's wonderful. Inevitably we will have a number of actors who are coming in for the first time, and we drill it in them that no, you have to be able to adapt. You have to know what your purpose is, what your drive, you know, within any scene that you're going into, when your entrance time is, but then you have to be able to adapt and, you know, go and walk the space when we get to each space and make any of the changes that you need to. You know, we do a fight call. Many of Shakespeare's shows have fights in them, as you probably know. We'll do a fight call at every space and we take a little bit of extra time to make sure that we have what we need, because again, we're dealing with unknowns. And, you know, if we need to shift something a little bit farther downstage or upstage because of any, you know, situation, we've got to kind of do that on the fly. And it really, again, from that artistic standpoint, especially for the actors, I think it really helps to tune in on the moment, so that you have to listen more. You have to be aware of not just what you're doing and what your storyline is through the show, but also, you know, what's going on in your surroundings with the other actors or with the audience. You know, you've really got to be tuned into that much more. So again, it can be really rewarding.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, theater is rewarding in itself for the people who love doing it and love watching it. That's been emphasized quite a bit over the last year and a half as we've gotten through COVID and all of its crap that it hurls at us, you know, one element at a time. Did you doing your shows outside, did that lend itself a little bit to COVID? I mean, is it, because I know a lot of companies, they went outside for their theater. Was that already in place and it helped you?
Yes, absolutely. Spot on. Okay. We, during 2020, we decided we still wanted to present something for an audience, but we decided to do so digitally. We still did two shows. We did Julius Caesar and Comedy of Errors. We filmed them though, and we filmed them entirely outside. So maintaining 6 feet of distance between actors, it was a bit of an editing nightmare in the end, but it was well worth it. It's well worth it. And, you know, we were able to continue through with that. In 2021, we came back and because we had all of these things in place, we're used to performing outdoors. We didn't have to change our shows all that much. We encouraged the audience to safely distance themselves. And because of being outdoor venue, because we don't have any sort of like, you know, we don't have restrictions where, you know, you have to pay in attendance or get a ticket or anything like that. So we don't have any barriers to our performance or our audience space. So people could sit 20 feet away from anybody else if they wanted to, or right. 50 feet away, you know? And they could really isolate in their own little, you know, the pods that we always talked about. And our performance, you know, it worked out well because the vaccine was available then. And, you know, it was we were able to do an almost unadulterated, uninhibited performance. Although we did pare it down to just one show for the 2021 season, but other than that, we weren't too terribly affected by it, which is really fortunate. And we're really, you know, really happy that we were able to do that.
Wow, that's great. It really is, because so many people, they have their own theaters and they just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Or they work in a steady theater, somebody else's steady theater. And that can be like so difficult. And so I think that's great. That's the first thing that I thought when I saw that you do your productions outside. I'm like, wow, that really sort of dovetailed into a fortunate, like some fortunate luck there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do, you know, you know, I cannot wait for things to get back to what we think of as normal. You know, I mean, obviously, and, you know, for the theater community at large, as well as just everyone's personal lives. But, you know, I'm really glad to see all of the theaters, or at least the vast majority of theaters, finding ways to adapt. And yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, that yes, a lot of theaters moved outside because it was necessary. And, you know, and I'm so glad that they were able to, and have been able to push through and just find a way forward, even if it means, you know, not quite doing, you know, their regular routine. But, you know, that again can be a blessing in disguise, because, you know, who knows what they're doing. Like, by moving outside, they're able to find new ways of doing things. They're able to push themselves in different ways than they were before. And you know, they might be able to take some of that with them, you know, learning new lessons, or, you know, just finding different ways of doing things. I mean, that's what art is. It's about expression and in my thoughts, adapting. And that's what we've seen really come out of this. So again, I don't want to say it's a blessing, but it, you know, I think that there are some good things that may come from this later on down the road.
The previous series that I did on this show is called Act Two Places. Audience, if you want to hear about what Dustin is talking about from other theater administrators, actors, artistic directors, there's a whole series that I did, including two cumulative episodes, where these particular artists and companies talked about their experience from the very, very beginning, when they were just like, all we're doing is making sure everyone is okay, to how they evolved throughout the pandemic and what they're doing now. And so just if you really want to hear a lot about that, you know, then go back and visit that series. It's I'm pretty proud of it. And it's just, it's interesting to hear the arc of what people went through. I mean, was that sort of like, tell me about that first day when everybody had to close down. Oh, what was it like for you? What was the first day like?
I mean, it was nightmarish, you know. I think I spent more time scrolling through the news on my phone than I ever had before, you know. I mean, you know, it was just a wave of, you know, things closing, things shutting down. We had an impromptu meeting with all of my board, and we decided that we were going to move forward in one way or another. And we ended up doing that. It was late in the game that we decided, it was after we had cast our season. We had decided to keep moving forward before we held auditions, but after we cast our season, we then decided to change things up and move to a digital filmed version, which was, you know, it was a surprise. It was a bit of a surprise to everyone, although we did sort of, you know, come at this as saying like, this is sort of our last case scenario, but we ended up having to move into that last case scenario. And I was just really fortunate that I had a board that you know, wasn't willing to throw in the towel, that said, no, you know, our mission is important. And you know, we're going to see it through as best we can in whatever way we can. And that was, I mean, that was the reality of it.
Yeah. Wow. That was a weird day. It really was. Yeah. I remember out here in New York, people were asking me, because I live in New York, people were asking me, do you think Broadway's going to close down? And I was like, are you kidding? Broadway's a $1 billion business. There's no way they're going to. And then like literally 3 days later, boom, everything's shutting down.
Yeah.
So I mean, it was for everyone.
It was a ghost town everywhere, you know? Uh-huh. I mean, you know, I have my wife and I have a dog, and we, you know, we inevitably would go and walk her. But like, I mean, it was just like, it was one of those where you're out walking along the streets, and we live in a fairly, you know, decent arts district, which is really nice. And, but it was just a ghost town. It was like so rare to see anybody else out just walking or doing anything, you know, alive outside. Mm-hmm. And when we did, it was so weird because you had to, you know, walk to the other side of the street to avoid them, but still like kind of say hi, cause you're like, it's another person. I haven't seen you in so long. Right. You right. know, I haven't seen anybody, you know, so it was such a bizarre time. And, you know, again, I mean, I think the end is in sight. I know we've got a long ways to go, but I'm just so looking forward to that day when, you know, we can kind of maybe in one small way put this behind us.
I want it all behind us. I want it back to the way it was. Okay, let's talk about your selection process for the plays that you're going to do. How do you go about picking them out of Shakespeare's vault of plays?
Yeah, so you know, every summer we typically tour with two productions. Occasionally we will do an off-season show, a third show that we either produce or will partner with another organization or theater. But inevitably, most often, our shows are either from or inspired by the works of William Shakespeare. So, you know, we will, I would say actually, we have done, we've actually produced every play in Shakespeare's canon except for five, which is really nice throughout the years. But you know, we also will do shows that are, you know, sort of Shakespeare adjacent from the time of Shakespeare, or shows that are inspired by, like, we've done Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, and, you know, and things of that nature. But more importantly than, you know, whether we do Shakespeare, whether we do something that's inspired by Shakespeare, more importantly is that each show, it needs to offer something to our community. It needs to be relevant to the time. And, you know, it needs to be in that vein and offer something, more than just picking a show because it's fun, we want to do it, or anything like that. You know, we haven't done this in a while, that sort of thing. So, you know, this coming year, we're producing Hamlet and The Learned Ladies, which is actually our first time that we are going to be producing a Molière piece. The Learned Ladies, it's Molière's last great play. We're doing a translation by Timothy Mooney, and we're really excited for that. That's going to be something sort of venturing into, you know, another realm for us a little bit. So, but, you know, as far as the process goes, I mean, I guess probably one of the bigger things that we do is, yes, we, you know, it is important to offer something to our communities, as I said, but we also work with the directors that we're bringing in. So we want it to be something that they want to do. We're not going to be like, we're selecting this and we want you to direct it. It's, we work with them right off the bat when we're like, hey, we'd like you to come direct with us. What are some shows that you would, you know, enjoy doing? And, you know, and like just this past year, I met with, 8 or 9 different directors that I would love to all, I would love to bring them all in. And I wasn't able to do that this coming year, obviously, but, you know, but I kind of have them in the back burner going, okay, this would be great, but not, you know, these ideas that you have would be wonderful, not for this year though. So, you know, are you open to directing in the future? And, you know, for the most part they are. And it's, you know, it's just that collaborative process as far as determining what we do.
That's great. It's wonderful that you know, you give directors opportunities, you give them an opportunity to express what they want to do. Mm-hmm. And then match it up with, it sounds like sociologically, whatever's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. And that's actually really smart because it infuses, it gets to the audience because it's something they've been hearing about and thinking about and, wanting to change or whatever. And it also gives passion to the director.
Yeah.
And the direct, it's like a passion project for them in a way.
You know, as a director, I mean, I myself always look at a show, and if I, you know, I come at it from an acting standpoint. If I can envision myself in a role, I'm going to want to play that role, right? Mm. As a director, I need to be able to, in my mind, envision myself in almost every single role. You know, whether it's the villain, whether it's, you know, the antagonist or the protagonist, whether it's a, you know, a one-off character, or whether it's, you know, the character that binds the show together. But I need to see what those characters, where they're coming from, gain a relation to them, because then I'm, you know, that way I'm able to actually help direct it. I'm able to actually, you know, I can envision myself living as that character so I can have a sense of what that character needs to, what part that character needs to play within the overall arc of the play.
I think that's so important. I think that connection to Shakespeare is paramount in its importance because I'll be honest, I'm not a big Shakespeare fan. And the reason why is because when I'm watching a Shakespeare play, there, to me, there is a chasm that's created there by the language. And for the longest time I was like, I'm one of those people who I want to understand every single line. And then somebody in my writing group said, why don't you just go and sit there and let the experience wash over you? And I thought, wow, okay, well, I'll try. And so I set a goal to go to one Shakespeare play a year, also one ballet and one opera, because I think if you do that, then you're connecting maybe not to every single line, but to the big beats of the story.
Yeah.
It's great, and it's always much better when the actors are understanding their language. They're not just out there spouting it like pink poetry. It's just, they're breaking down each line and, oh, okay, well I get that now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it really, when you approach Shakespeare, it needs to stem from the text. You know, Shakespeare, although we often think of it that like Shakespeare is this foreign language, it's actually still modern English. You know, it's, you know, maybe not the English that we text with, but it's still, you know, modern English, and the words that we use are, they're not foreign. But as you said, yeah, it's this heightened language, and it's so hard to kind of dig your way into it and to comprehend it, especially when you're just kind of hearing it. But I mean, if I were to just dribble on about whatever it is without any meaning to the sounds that I was making, even though I may actually be speaking English, it's still going to sound, you know, incoherent to you because there's no underlying subtext to it. There's no, you know, there's no thought that I'm trying to deliver because I'm just rambling off some words that I may have memorized. But if you dig in, as I said, to the text, which is really where you need to start, where the director, the actors come into this is by digging in, gaining the meaning of the language, gaining the meaning that the characters, the thoughts that the characters are having, and then understanding those thoughts, bringing them to life through the use of the language, through the text, then all of a sudden, you know, the text that Shakespeare wrote is just a vehicle for the thought process that is trying to be conveyed. I mean, it's the same thing that I'm doing right now. I'm trying to, you know, express to you and listeners, you know, just this complex, you know, process by using the language that I'm doing. I'm just making it up as I go. But really, I mean, it just comes down to that. It just comes down to digging into the text, you know, that's kind of as a segue into, you know, just sort of my own thoughts with this is, you know, when I personally do it, and I look at a play, I will start with the first folio, which, it's a collection of Shakespeare's works. It was printed in 1623. And, the first folio, I mean, it's a collection of all of his plays, or most of his plays. I dig into that because, it has so many context clues written in it, in the punctuation, the capitalization, of the words and thoughts. And those act as road signs for the actor so that when, you know, they will have, you know, a particular word is capitalized, there'll be like a noun or a verb that's, you know, that's capitalized and they can go, okay, that word is important. And so they kind of find those context clues and build the overarching thought process, around that. And, you know, really starting there in my mind, sort of at the source is very important for then building that clarity, which I think is important for you, the listener or the watcher, is building that clarity for you. So ultimately, no matter where we start, we're aiming towards that. We're bringing out those thoughts and those and the language and trying to make it as clear for you. And as you pointed out, yeah, you, you know, sometimes you don't understand every little detail. And, you know, maybe you've read the play, maybe you haven't read the play, maybe you've read a summary of the play, maybe you're just going in totally, you know, totally blind to it all. But there's still so much that you can absorb. And if done right, I think both the language and the physical presence of the actors on stage by bringing it to life, they can do so much to help with that clarity and making it something that, as I said, even if it's not every moment, you're still able to take something significant from it.
Which makes it work on two levels, because you're entertaining people who don't necessarily aren't really at the level of connecting with the language that other people are. And you're also entertaining the people who have connected with the language and have studied it and understand it. So that, I think that's one of, in my opinion, I don't know if Shakespeare intended this, probably not, because he just wrote in the language that the vernacular that he spoke. But I think it's pretty genius because it can work on both levels. So that's terrific. Talk about your production process.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, really, I think most, you know, it probably aligns with most rehearsals, most other theaters' production process as it goes forward. But, you know, one thing I will say that we actually discovered during the pandemic is, you know, all of our auditions moved to this online format. We had our actors record their auditions, send them in mostly through, you know, YouTube or some other, you know, some other place to post videos. Right. But that process, although I really missed the personal connection that you get with it, with an audition, that process is probably going to be something that stays with us, with us particularly for Cleve Shakes. You know, it just saves so much time and resources by, you know, we don't have to have the actors come in. We don't have to have them congregate all together and huddle in a, you know, a room before they come on to the, you know, into the room to audition. They, you know, it, as I said, it saves this time and resources. And then, you know, through that process, we are again moving forward. We're going to, we would then move to live callbacks. And so that's something that we're looking at for this coming year in our process, and we're going to see how it kind of works out. Mm-hmm. But then when we actually get into the rehearsal room, you know, it starts with the text, as I've said before, starts with us reading the play, understanding the play, and it might be a good week and a half before we actually get up and start physicalizing things. You know, we're doing a lot of table work. We're doing a lot of understanding because, yes, we have actors that come in that are seasoned professionals. As I said, one of our actors have been with us for like 23 years. We also have actors that are, you know, sometimes doing Shakespeare for the very first time, or have just, you know, maybe come out of their undergraduate program and have maybe taken a class on it, you know? And so, you know, we approach it from that learning standpoint of what is this play? What are we telling with this play? And who are you? Who is your character? Who are you throughout the process? And then, you know, we start to put it up on its feet. I will say also one way that we probably differ from most other theaters is when we get to Tech Week, because we're outside, we don't have to worry about, you know, lights. We don't have to worry about some of these technical elements that go into a lot of indoor theaters. You know, our light is the sun. And, you know, we sit down and we perform at 7 o'clock and we end by 9 o'clock because that's when the sun sets. And, you know, so that's, it fits in within that. So, you know, so during our tech week, actually, we are, and again, we perform at so many different spaces. We actually take our tech week to one of our location spaces and we're performing outside, and we're doing this in a public park. And, you know, we're doing a live rehearsal and people kind of wander in. You know, we maybe have some signs up, but we're not promoting it. We have some signs up to let people know what's going on. And people walk by with their dog or are biking through and they'll like pause and watch. And sometimes they'll sit and watch for like 20, 30 minutes. Which is nice. It kind of helps the audience almost like a preview. It helps them get accustomed to having an audience in front of them. Mm-hmm. But you know, that's our tech week. It's actually out and open and it's not a private affair. So that's probably one of our biggest sort of, I personally love that aspect. You know, it's very transparent, but it's probably one of the biggest ways that we differ from most traditional theaters.
But that's cool though when that happens, when you like just sort of walk up to art and you turn the corner and something artistic is happening for you. I think that's really, really neat. It reminds me of once when David and I were in Paris and we're walking around and we went to, I think it's called the Pompidou. It's the big staircase. And we were going there. All of a sudden, we turned the corner, and there's this giant, like, human mobile in the middle of the square with people hanging. One's playing a violin, and, you know, one's clowning. And I just thought, I just remember that. And I thought, how fortunate we are that we just walked up to that. Like, we turned the corner, and there it was.
It is so, it's so serendipitous. It's so wonderful, and just such a lovely surprise.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And great for people who aren't necessarily into art. It's, you know, other than, you know, maybe they see their kids play or something like that. Yeah. I think it's really cool.
Several years ago, we actually, I love this story I can't remember the actual show, but we were in the middle of a tech and, these group of three girls, they were young, probably like the oldest was maybe 14. Youngest was probably 6 or 7. And they were just standing at the edge watching us for like 10 or 15 minutes. And I'm directing. So I'm kind of like wandering about, you know, the audience looking at different angles and things like that. And I noticed them and I kind of, you know, just keep them in my peripheral, just kind of, you know, how long they're staying. As I said, they stay for like 10 or 15 minutes. They're just watching. And it's like, they're just these young girls that are experiencing this, didn't know what was happening or, you know, that this was happening. And then, you know, after 10 or 15 minutes, they wander off and I'm like, okay, great. That gave them such a wonderful experience. But then 5 minutes later, they come back and they've gotten snacks from the local grocery store and they sit down with the snacks and finish watching the show. And it was like, it was just such a lovely, experience. And it, you know, I'm sure, I hope that it stuck with them, but it sure stuck with me. And that's really at the heart of what we do, just giving it unto the community for them to partake as they will. And, you know, these, I'm guessing sisters were able to come and enjoy this, and hopefully they went back and told their parents and, you know, and just, you know, it gave them that lasting memory.
You may have sparked one of them into being an actor.
Yeah.
You know, and for sure now they're going to be interested in Shakespeare because you and your team brought that to them. And again, they just walked in. Now I love human mobiles, so I know exactly how they feel.
Yeah.
Now you've worked from, I understand from your bio that you've worked in a lot of theater areas, if you will, theater locales. Now, you've worked in New York, right?
Not New York City, but the states. I've gone and I've done a number of colleges throughout the state. So,
okay. Cool. What are some of the challenges facing the Cleveland Shakespeare Festival in the context of producing in the same sort of overall theater world? Let's just say we group all of theater together. What are some of the challenges that you face that aren't really occurring as much in the larger known areas of theater production?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I love theater, and I love going to see, you know, I love going and attending some of our larger theaters here in Cleveland, and off, you know, taking it, even going and visiting Broadway. Wonderful things. I'm incredibly happy for the success that any theatrical organization is able to find, you know, huge and small. You know, outside of New York City, Cleveland is the second largest theater district in the country.
Really?
It is. Yes. We are, I mean, saturated with theater. It really is a blessing. You know, and I'm grateful to be a part of, you know, this web of art and expression within our city. But you know, one of the largest frustrations that I have is when I go to seek funding or, you know, some kind of promotion or something. And I hear, you know, does Cleveland really need another theater? And it's that saying, and I've heard this a number of times. My first thought from hearing, you know, does Cleveland really need another theater or any city, you know, sub in any city? My first thought is, you know, I mean, we've been around for 25 years now. So I'm like, well, we're not just another theater, but you know, we're small enough that you may not be hugely aware of us. But my usual response is yes, we do. We do need another theater because, you know, there's clearly a voice that needs to be heard and it doesn't have an outlet. So, you know, I mean, growing a theater organization is hard. It's not easy, and no one's going to do it if it's not important to them. If they don't, you know, have a drive or a reason for bringing their art into existence. But you know, as I said, if they need a voice, if they need their voice to be heard, they're going to do it. And on a fundamental level, I understand the question as well. You know, there, as I said, there's a saturation of theater here. And it can be hard to try and garner funding because you have so many theaters. I mean, I don't know the number that we have in Cleveland, but it is, you know, we, you know, in the pandemic, we had a meeting, a digital meeting it invited to every single theater out there. And I think we had, 50 or 60 different attendees with that. And no one was allowed to bring more than two people to it. So, you know, just within this, you know, within the Cleveland area, that's, you know, we've got, you know, probably we have dozens of theaters. So the saturation is real. And, you know, why do we need to bring more things into our lives to watch or listen to? You know, I mean, we have so much content out there. You know, I get it. It takes up our time. But you know, the one thing that theater, and I think small theaters really get a handle on is the locality of the art form. You know, again, nothing against the Broadways of the world, you know, that, you know, who, you know, people, you know, it's a huge event and, you know, people will fly in from everywhere, part of the world to see a show. That is wonderful. But, you know, theater can be an incredibly local entity too. You know, and art is, it's literally meant for a limited number of people to experience. You know, there are only so many tickets. It only runs for so long. You know, the standard is you don't record it. It is meant to be an experience, and it is meant to, you know, there's a limitation to that experience. So, you know, crafting your art to serve the personal and local needs and purposes of your community is the key for, you know, for smaller theaters. And that's where we can thrive. And, you know, that's where we can specialize in.
You know, what's great is that I've just totally learned something from you. And I wrote down here, the saturation can be a challenge. I mean, I get that. It's there when there's so much, it's like, who do you pick? Or does your brain just go, I can't pick. Plus, again, it's a lot of companies fighting for funding. You know, and who do you donate to? It's a lot of that. That's a very interesting theory. That's why I like doing these series, because, you know, I'm thinking like, you know, you're going to say something like, well, they have more money than we do, or which I know is probably the case, considering the fact that it's millions of dollars out here, but that's a really cool answer. I like that answer. That's awesome.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, you know, really digging in deep and swimming within, you know, the needs and daily activities of a small theater. I mean, that's your reality. You know, I mean, that's what you're dealing with on a almost daily basis. So, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. As a writer, I've had shows produced, and I'm always just, when I go into, because usually when you're the writer, you'll sit in the rehearsal room and tweak the script. That's pretty much all you do. And give an interview here and there. But, you know, you already have your own writer that's, you know, provided you a lot of work, which is awesome. But I'm always, like, when I'm watching the production process, I'm always like, oh, my God, this is a lot of work. And sometimes with these production companies, these theater production companies, it's not a big payoff,
yeah,
because of the oversaturation. Not that that's what's happening with you guys. I don't know, but that is a syndrome.
It can be. It certainly can be.
Yeah, and yeah.
I don't know my way through. You know, I don't know the perfect way through that. You know, I think it's a problem that we just have to take on an individual basis. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I always tell people you're competing with so many things that you don't even realize until you go through it. Like, you know, well, TV and platforms and movies when we're from the before and hopefully after times. Mm-hmm. And you know, driving, parking. There's so many things that you really have to get the perception of the audience over.
Yeah.
To get them there. And so I feel you. I really do. That's tough, which is why I'm glad that you guys do it for free and you're mm-hmm. in a locale where people normally congregate.
Yeah.
So that's very, very cool. What are some of the misconceptions of smaller, more independent theaters? And it could be from the Cleveland Shakespeare Festival, or it could be from some of your other experiences.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think that we've been kind of talking around it, and you mentioned it for certain, is that, you know, I mean, it's, I would say misconception is that even though small theaters don't have the resources that larger theaters often do, they're sometimes viewed as of lesser quality. They're sometimes viewed as maybe not worthwhile. You know, all coming from an individual standpoint, right? Everybody, you know, has their own, you know, their own ways of valuing, you know, art. But, you know, I think that having a larger budget for a show doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a better show. You know, all theater really it relies on the audience's imagination, no matter whether you can throw $1 million into it or, you know, $50 into, you know, whatever show. You are still relying on an audience to come in and, you know, suspend their disbelief, as the term goes, right? To go, I'm not sitting in a theater, and watching a show. No, I'm living in this experience. I'm taking it in. And I know that those are actors on there, but I'm going to believe that no, that person really did just, you know, kill that other person or whatever it may be, you know, that we can just kind of dig ourselves into. No matter what the level of funding is, we all have to rely on the audience's imagination. So I feel like the quality of, you know, theater should be based on how well the art they produce taps into that. You know, how well they tell the story. That's really what it comes down to, no matter what, with or without, you know, the bells and whistles of it all. And, you know, specifically for us, for Cleve Shakes, as we call it, you know, because we're free, you know, sometimes we're taken for granted by the communities we serve, or overlooked. But, you know, because we're free and because we're outdoors, we actually have an abnormally high proportion of younger audience members that come to see our shows. You know, we're talking about, you know, families who they don't have to worry about, you know, laying down $100 to $400 or more to, you know, bring them and their kids to see a show. Right. And, you know, to crowd into a darkened space. Darkened theater, and you know, hoping that their 7-year-old, who they want to give this exposure to culture, but hoping that they don't get bored halfway through and start to cause a commotion or something along those lines. You know, we get a lot of families that come to see our show because we're outdoors, we're in the parks, and you know, if young children that are experiencing Shakespeare possibly and probably for the first time. You know, they may only want to sit for 20 minutes before they need to get up and go to the other end of the park to play on the playground for a little bit, but they're still absorbing, you know, what theater is and what Shakespeare is or whatever show that we have to offer. And, you know, this may be going a little bit off the point, but, you know, on a personal note, you know, I grew up and I was one of those families that We didn't have money for theater. We you know, I mean, you know, I loving parents and a loving household. But you know, we were definitely not well off. And it was this art, this culture was something that I didn't experience, you know, and it wasn't until I believe I was a sophomore in high school and we were studying Julius Caesar. And we studied Romeo and Juliet my freshman year and I hated it. Just probably many freshmen do. I couldn't stand it. I didn't understand it or anything like this. But you know, I got placed in this English class and I was struggling. I was like a C-, you know, at best. But we get to this Julius Caesar segment and I just flourished. Like I just found my way and I turned into like an A student, almost an A+ student in that. And the teacher who was also the drama teacher for the school, Mrs. Higgins, a lovely, lovely human being. She saw that and I don't know if it was because of this. I like to think it was, but that's just probably my own personal, pride coming into it. But she saw that and she brought the class. She had an extracurricular, experience, a field trip. She took the class to a Shakespeare play. We went to see Taming of the Shrew. And that was my first live show. And I saw it and I didn't understand, I'm sure, almost any of it, but I loved it. I loved the vibrancy of it and it was so alive and it was wonderful. And you know, it was that accessibility that honestly, it changed my course. I mean, you know, I started getting into theater. I went to school and, you know, I can really attribute all of my successes and failures in the theater world back to that, because without it, I don't know what course I would have taken. But that was, you know, that was fundamental. And so, you know, being able to offer that, trying to segue this back to your question, being able to offer that as a small theater, who, you know, brings their shows for free to an audience and allows, not even allows, like requires or, you know, expects the audience to give their imagination into it, to invest in it themselves. I hope, you know, if we can, if we could do what happened for me to one person, I would consider, I mean, my whole endeavor, my whole professional career success. And I hope, you know, I hope that we do that. And I hope that we do that every year, but, you know, but the fact that we offer it and that we do this and we're able to do it as a small theater that is able to move through that. I mean, that's, I think that's paramount.
Wow. It sounds like you've already, like you knew the misconceptions that people would have and you geared your mission towards busting those. And that's very cool.
Yeah. And I will say I didn't come up with the mission, you know, I was the, you know, or well, my personal mission, the mission of the, of Cleve Shakes, which has existed forever. I mean, and it just fits in. I found my way to Cleveland Shakespeare Festival, and was able to fit in with that and really, you know, and really utilize it. And it's just, it's wonderful that these kinds of, organizations exist. So, yeah.
It, you related to it, I think, because it was your story.
Yeah.
You know, just presented and like, yeah, that's what I want to do. And, I think that's wonderful. I really do. Because again, when I was writing out these questions, cause you're the first show of this topic, I was thinking people were going to be more like gripes. You know what I mean? Like, we don't have this. But what you're doing is you're saying, this is how we are different in a good way. And I think that that's amazing. It's opening my eyes and, you know, clearing up a lot of my ignorance. And I appreciate that. Now, I want to say, I love what you said about the families and people going to a park and it's more relaxed. I just thought of something, and you probably have thought of this many times. That kind of situation really lends itself to the way Shakespeare was originally produced at the Old Globe Theater. And I know, yeah, you know that, right?
Oh yeah. There are parallels. I mean, it's all, you know, we're all groundlings in the audience. We're all just sitting there experiencing it, and it's meant for the audience. You know, yeah. We don't have a curtain to hide, you know, to close in, you know, to end the scene. And yeah, I mean, it is an immersive experience in a sense. Because we're out in the public. So there are people, even when we're performing, there are people walking their dogs and the dogs bark at the sword fight that's happening, or, you know, someone rides their bike. Years ago, we had someone who was oblivious and they rode their bike right between the audience and the stage. It was just like, what are you doing? Funny. You know, but that it brings, you know, it's a little bit of the elephant in the room, but it also brings everybody together and it shows that, yeah, art can happen anywhere. You don't need to, you know, just as you said, your installment of people the was it Ariel, like the hanging, you know, the
a giant crane with people hanging off on
strings. That was it.
It was very Cirque du Soleil.
Art can happen anywhere, and that it's so rewarding. Yeah.
Wow. Very cool. Okay. You are an award-winning fight choreographer and stage combat instructor. What's that like?
Yeah. I have to say that, you know, stage combat and particularly, choreographing fights, is one of the many, but one of my highest loves in my life. It's so much fun. You know, I get to play with swords almost on a daily basis. The 8-year-old inside of me is just happy as all get out. But, you know, I started off training in The Art of Stage Combat, which is for everyone, just to set it, stage combat is sort of the illusion of violence for theatrical purposes. So oftentimes it tells a story through this quote unquote violence, which is, as I said, an illusion. It is meant so that it is safe for the actors and the audience, but it is also intended to look real and be visually impressive and storytelling for storytelling purposes. So, I started training this in my undergrad at Ashland University, and I went on to study with the Society of American Fight Directors. I found out that I kind of had a knack for it. Something inside of me like clicked as I did it. And as I said, it's one of the loves of my life is doing this. So I have, I've done freelance choreography, with almost every theater here in Cleveland. I've done a number of universities, all throughout Ohio and New York. I've gone out to the Idaho Shakespeare Festival, and done, their Richard III with their education department. I've probably choreographed, I don't know, anywhere from 70 to 80 productions, throughout the number of years that I've been doing it. The fight experience was probably my foot in the door when it came to getting involved in Shakespeare, Shakespearean productions. The directors knew that I could handle a sword. So, I could be cast as, someone, one of the fighters within the plays. And that's really where I kind of got my start. And then I started to understand the language and the story of Shakespeare more and more. And that led to me to actually choreographing, and not just performing, but doing the choreography for, I've done dozens of Romeos and Juliets. I cannot tell you how many fights of that show I have done. And then that eventually led me to directing Shakespeare because really at the heart of stage combat is dealing with physicalizing, conflict. It's when conflict escalates beyond words or beyond, and it takes form of violent action, right? Mm-hmm. Which conflict is at the heart of every story that we tell, whether it's on stage or off, but still it's about conflict is what drives a story forward. So that really kind of led me into, it led me into this realm and it gave me the introduction to Shakespeare that I really needed.
Wow. I remember I've taken two acting classes in my life, and the reason why I took them is because, as a writer, I wanted to know the limitations of the actors on stage, mm-hmm. like what they have to deal with up there. And, in my second year, my more advanced acting class, I chose to do a scene from the play Extremities.
Yeah.
Which is so much violence for the audience out there. It's, a play about, a lady who is, almost followed home, if you will, or by a rapist and attacks her, and then she flips it on him.
Yeah.
I mean, it's insane. Farrah Fawcett did it mm-hmm. here in New York, I think after Susan Sarandon did it, and she did the movie. And we did the most violent of scenes because I was like, I want to know what the actor is having to deal with. And my husband, who was pretty good at fight choreographer, he was directing mm-hmm. us, and he told me, the rule is that the victim is always in control. Yep. They control the direction of the fight, not the person who's instigating the violence. He told me that. And then secondly, I just learned that, oh my God, they're remembering their blocking, their lines, their characterization, and now they're remembering counts and keeping each other safe while you're doing this. It really adds a lot to what they're doing.
Yeah.
And it really when I saw that in your bio, it was like, okay, I gotta ask. I mean, what is your, do you have a system for this, or do you have theories, or what have you?
I mean, I, you know, really what it comes down to is, you know, it is about storytelling. And I mean, I'm trained in the Stanislavski technique. So it really comes down to, you know, the action of it, right? And what that action, what the intention is. So when I approach, you know, any sort of choreography, you know, the first thing that I do is I ask the actors, you know, when I'm in the room, I ask the actors what their, you know, what constraints they have personally, what their comfort level is. And I set up an open dialogue, because yeah, you know, as, you know, in the case of the extremities, you know, it can get dark. And there's so many times where it can just be light and fluffy, you know, I mean, like it can just be fun, you know, the Three Musketeers, which may not be light and fluffy, but it's adventurous, right? So it doesn't always have to be incredibly dark, you know, these moments that I'm, that, you know, we're going into choreography. But regardless, the actor needs to be comfortable and confident in what they're doing. It's like if they go on stage and they don't know their lines, they can't act. They're actors trying to find their lines. Mm-hmm. If they're not comfortable with what they're doing, whether it's fight choreography or just walking down a set of staircase, they can't act. They're uncomfortable in the moment. So they're trying to deal with that stimuli and not able to do the job that everyone has come to see them do. Mm-hmm. So really at a fundamental level, it starts there. And then beyond that, then you go, well, okay, how can we fit what we need to do into the director's vision, and how can we do it in a way that the audience will believe it, buy into it, and hopefully enjoy it in whatever sense that enjoy means, that they will take from it what they, you know, what they need to take from it for the story's sake. So, you know, I mean, that's kind of my philosophical approach to it. And then, you know, on a practical level, it just, you know, it comes down to the actors that I'm working with and the needs from the director and, you know, and all the other constraints that come into it.
Yeah. It's almost like stage magic in a way.
Yeah.
Because I remember he did a lot of, when he acted in a play called Oleana. It's a David Mamet play. I'm sure you're familiar with it,
yeah.
But it's, for the audience, it's about a suction. It's a two character play about, I don't want to say sexual harassment. It's about a perception of violence and it's, you just have to read it or see it. There's a movie of it. But it's just about a college professor and one of his students, and she comes in and, you know, she's confronting him on a lot of stuff that has to do with where he is. He's, crossing lines.
Hmm.
And in the end, there is a big fight. And I remember when I first saw him do it, I was like, oh my God, that looked real. But he's like, oh no, no. When we did this, you know, I had to slam her head down on the desk. And I actually, you know, she actually is the one who went down, and I just follow her with my hand. And I slammed the door of the desk so that nobody could see. That's where we got the sound. It's like a magic show.
It is. Yeah. There's, you know, I often describe it as it's a bit of dance. It's a bit of martial arts in a sense, or any sort of martial, you know, whether it be fencing or whether it be anything like that. Uh-huh. And then it's magic. There's sleight of hand. There's so much sleight of hand, and you have to play,
totally.
You have to play angles. You have to do, you know, what's the term I'm looking for? The miss, you know, you have to pull the audience's attention to something so that way you can mask something else. And you know, it's a magic show.
Yeah. And it's also dovetailed, and this is, I think, a really good thing, into intimacy coordinators, mm-hmm. who actually stage love scenes on stage that the actors can be comfortable with. In my opinion, I think a lot of that has to do with, you know what, he or she told me to do this, and that's why I'm doing it. If I cross a line, you let me know. I did a show on the Me Too element in theater a while back, and that's a very interesting show. If audience, if you'd like to listen to that, that talks a lot about people crossing lines and what it was all female actors, and what is expected in those situations. you know, it's, there's a lot of boundaries, a lot more boundaries, I think, than people really understand. And if they don't understand, I think that's, I mean, by that, I mean, audience, I think that makes for a better moment because they're believing that it's real.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And, intimacy direction or choreography is, it's very relatable to stage combat. And actually a lot of fight choreographers, was actually developed by a fight choreographer, I believe she, it was developed by a fight choreographer, and I don't know all of my facts on this, so I don't want to make up and say something that I shouldn't. But a lot of people in the fight world move into that, and they study it as well. And I've done a handful of workshops myself on that because it's translatable, and it's something that is, you know, it's oftentimes, or for the longest time, it was overlooked. And I think that we as a society, and certainly as an art form, are heading in a right direction towards that. And I think that we still have quite a ways to go to make, you know, the Me Too movement and everything like that, that we still have a long way to go to, you know, to really find balance and where it should be. But I'm very happy that we are moving in the right direction. So.
Oh, absolutely. It really is. The actor has to be primary in whatever's going on up there. And it does have to be controlled. There was a theater company, I won't name it, but they studied a certain technique and applied it to their productions, and things would just get out of hand because there were no boundaries set. It was like, whatever you're feeling, just do it. And that's, that can offend a lot of people. And so I'm glad we're getting away from that. I really am. I don't know how somebody could actually break that boundary, but people do or did.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. If you could, as artistic director, have three wishes for the development of the Cleveland Shakespeare Festival, what would they be?
This is such a good question. I mean, it's like, it's just so open-ended. You know,
thanks.
I mean,
it's not my first time.
Yeah. Are you secretly a genie? Are you able to grant these? Because that might alter the way that I wish. Is that no?
No.
Yeah.
I could barely accomplish my own goals.
You know, every theater every theater, no matter how big or small, I mean, every theater can use more money. You know, I mean, it just helps things work. But you know, that's such a boring answer or wish. So, you know, I think more specifically in what like we would do had we, you know, that money or whatnot is, you know, ultimately I would love for us to have a larger facility here in Cleveland for Cleveland Shakespeare Festival, a larger facility that would allow us to really expand our education programming, just like you spoke at the beginning with Gilmore Academy. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I mean, just having a state of the art facility that we can, you know, expand what we do, and both on the production level, but again, you know, as I said, for our education programming, I would love that. The second would be a touring stage truck. You know, like an old, I would love to have like an old, you know, one of those wagons that fold out a dozen different times into a stage, you know, with trapdoors and curtains that, you know, scroll in from the wings. Maybe not without the like horse and carriage kind of thing to it, but you know, having something like that, that we could take through the city. It was iconic, and it really, like, you know, they'd be like, you know, oh, that's the you know, that's the Shakespeare Festival. And then, you know, we could unfold it in a park and, you know, and raise up a flag to show that the audience, that we're doing a show, and the audience would come flocking in. I would love that. And then for third, I would say, if we discovered, like in my attic, we discovered, you know, the last remaining manuscript of a long lost Shakespeare play, Love's Labor is One or something, you know, we could put on the premiere performance of it. That's what I would love, that we could be that iconic and be like at the center of something like that. You know, that one's maybe a little bit larger than life, but you know, that would be awesome. So those are my three.
We can dream, can't we?
That's right. That's right.
I love it. I'm writing it down.
Okay, good. Hey, listen. If it changes and you can make any of those come true, you've got my email. So,
yeah, I may have to battle with the actual Old Globe Theater in London, but you know, hey,
yeah,
I am in fact me. So don't expect anything. By the way, if you've never been to the Old Globe Theater, I'm speaking directly to the audience. If you go to London, when we can travel again, you should book a reservation to go tour that. It is so cool. I think it's like the fourth or fifth version of it, but still, it's pretty like right on. It's cool.
Yeah, I know that so there's obviously the original that Shakespeare would have performed at. That burned down. And then I do believe they made another one. I don't know the time frame, but this was before they built a Globe Theater, but what they thought that it was before they actually threw, I think, some excavation, they discovered the actual foundation of it, and they were able to reconstruct it to the measurements of the actual Old Globe. So I think there's at least three renditions of this, and it might be more than that, but I know that's the story that I know. It's for certain those three.
It's really neat. The tour is great, and you can really see how people did theater back then and went to theater and enjoyed it. And they also have a great museum where they have costume pieces and stuff. I mean, it's if you love theater and you're in London, you very definitely have to book that. We took David's dad and he loved it, and he loves the theater that we do. Okay, before we go, please give our audience your social media information so that they can keep up with your company and also where people can donate money.
Sure. Yeah. So we're on Facebook, facebook.com/cleaveshakes. And all of this, Cleave Shakes, I'm going to spell this out because you're going to hear it a lot, but it's CleveSHakes. So CleveSHakes. So Facebook is facebook.com/cleaveshakes. Twitter is @cleaveshakesfest. Instagram is @cleaveshakes, and our website is www.cleaveshakes.org, which we will happily accept any and all donations through our website. You can donate through PayPal or a credit card.
Excellent. People go there and donate. They're doing free shows and they're wonderful and beautiful. So go there and kick down some money. You could do it. It's Christmas. It's the season for giving.
Thank you. Right. Yes. Yeah.
You have been such a wonderful guest. You're so knowledgeable and smart, and I love that you were okay with me not being the hugest fan of Shakespeare and explaining to. And I love that you acknowledge that you're okay. Like, not everybody is going to get it, and this is how you can try to get it.
I think Shakespeare has something to offer everyone. And, you know, you don't have to be a huge fan. You don't have to geek out about it like I do. But you know, he really does have something to offer everyone. And I hope that no matter where you are, whether it's Cleveland or, you know, any other city that you do, you check out your local, you know, your local Shakespeare festival or whatever it is. But, get some exposure to it. Cause I think you'll be surprised, and I think you'll just have a better understanding. So thank you. Thank you for having me on the show. I love this. You're wonderful. I love talking with you
and you.
Yeah, absolutely. This was great. Thank you.
Good. I'm glad you enjoyed yourself and you've imparted a lot of information to our listeners, and they appreciate it. And I appreciate it as well. You've been awesome. And I wish you and the Cleveland Shakespeare Festival many broken legs. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, folks, the 11 o'clock number has been sung and the bows have been taken, so it's time to lower the curtain. Once again, a big thanks to Dustin Welch of the Cleveland Shakespeare Festival. He was awesome. You can find more episodes of Your Program Is Your Ticket on the Broadway Podcast Network, who has honored me with a place on their incredible theater podcast platform. Broadway Podcast Network is all about creating an engaging, immersive, user-friendly experience where theater stories of all kinds can be found, shared, and enjoyed. Please visit them on my landing page at bpn.fm/ypiyt. Again, that's bpn.fm/ypiyt. Your Program Is Your Ticket is also on Facebook at facebook.com, Your Program Is Your Ticket. I'm on Twitter at Program Ticket, Instagram at Your Program Is Your Ticket, YouTube at Your Program Is Your Ticket. Also, I'm on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, Podcast Addict, Podbean, Pocket Casts, Deezer, TuneIn, Listen Notes, and the UK-based theater platform Thespian. FYI, I appreciate all good ratings, reviews, and subscriptions. Folks, take a little time to visit theater websites and see what they have to offer. Watch their content, give them all great ratings and reviews, and most importantly, donate, donate, donate. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time, and remember, theater is for everyone. And curtain.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.